As a journalist for over 20 years, I've often ignored the Jeffrey Epstein case, not because his story is not interesting, not relevant, he was a hugely powerful man, but I just haven't really looked into it. And I guess there's a few reasons for that. For so many years, there were so many conspiracy theories around Epstein. People often forget, with the information we know now, that Epstein was not as a well-known figure 20 years ago as he is now, after his death, although certainly people found out during his life his shameful and outrageous and disgusting connection with the abuse and rape of minors. And in fact, he did some quasi-jail time, very soft jail time for that, about just under 20 years ago. But one of the things I want to focus on today is something that much of the media has not talked about, and that's Epstein's clear ties with the Israeli state, Israeli intelligence, and Israeli forces. And there have been some outlets that have covered this, principally Dropsite News in the US. But I want to look at what those ties are, why they're being ignored by much of the media, what this says about our political and media class that is obsessed with Epstein, but not so much the elephant in the room, which is that Epstein was clearly, in some ways, an Israeli intelligence asset. Now, one of the reasons, in fact, I've ignored this issue for years has not been for any conspiratorial reason. It really goes to the heart of how we see conspiracy theories today. Some of you may remember during the 2016 US election campaign for president, when Donald Trump was running against Hillary Clinton, there was a conspiracy called Pizzagate, which basically was some bizarre conspiracy that found the New York Police Department had discovered a pedophile ring amongst the Democratic Party, led at that time by Hillary Clinton, in a pizza joint in Washington, D.C. Now, if I say it like that, it sounds bizarre and absurd and ridiculous. And one of the issues around that conspiracy at the time was essentially to say that our countries, our elites, are pedophiles, that we are controlled by pedophiles, that our leaders in country after country are either pedophiles themselves or pedophile supporters. That was a ridiculous conspiracy. It was complete bullshit. But what I think that has led to 10 years later is the Epstein files. What we've seen in the last months since Donald Trump has come back to power, although we still are missing, by the way, 3 million documents that have not been released about Epstein, is an incredibly dark reality of Epstein's connections to pretty much every global issue for the last 20, 30 years. He died in 2019, allegedly by suicide, but there's clear questions about whether he was potentially killed in prison. That deep ties to Israeli intelligence, American intelligence, and some of the most powerful people on the planet, Bill Gates, Prince Andrew, Bill Clinton, many others. Now, before we get into that, I just want to acknowledge one issue on this question, and that a whole part of the Epstein story, which we're not going to focus on today, but I want to acknowledge, is that his deep and long and absolutely outrageous life of wanting and raping underage girls. And the documents make it very clear now that he had a whole army of people assisting him, bringing him women. One of the key issues that has been clear around Epstein is his rape and abuse of children. And there's been a whole slew of documents that have come out that have explained this in detail. There was an army of people led by Ghislaine Maxwell, his, I guess, partner in crime, who essentially were finding children around the world and bringing them to him and others. I wanted to acknowledge here today that there's a book that was written not that long ago by a journalist called Lucia Osborne Crowley. And her book was about the trial of Ghislaine Maxwell. The book is called The Lasting Harm, Witnessing the Trial of Ghislaine Maxwell. This is how the book is described. In December 2021, Ghislaine Maxwell was convicted of 5 counts of sex trafficking of minors and is now serving 20 years in prison for the role she played in Jeffrey Epstein's abuse of 4 girls. The trial was meticulously covered by journalist and legal reporter Lucia Osborne Crowley, one of only 4 reporters allowed into the courtroom every day. I encourage people to look at that book, read that book, and consume that book, because it goes into great and meticulous detail about what Epstein was about in relation to finding the young girls and children to rape and abuse. And Maxwell was a key participant in that and facilitator. One of the issues that's become very noticeable for years around Epstein is the allegation that I have heard for a long time that he essentially was an Israeli intelligence asset. Now, for a long time, there was not a lot of hard evidence of this. It was innuendo, it was suggestion, it was implied. We have now, I would argue, pretty solid evidence that he was working at least in major ways and regularly as a go-between, as a facilitator, as a spokesperson for Israeli intelligence for years and years. Now, what does that practically mean? I don't think it necessarily means that he was going around the world spying necessarily just for Israel, though I think it's clear he was providing information to Israeli officials and officers. The documents that have come out in the last months have made it very clear he was very close to Ehud Barak, the former Israeli Prime Minister. Barak is one of the co-founders of Paragon, which is an Israeli spyware company, which has been complicit with ICE in the US going after surveilling Americans. It's been found on lots of phones of activists and journalists around the world. It's worth saying that in 2025, Paragon was sold to an American consortium of private interests. So Barak has been very involved in the surveillance and defense industry for a long time, but the documents show a deep and long relationship. Now, it's worth saying, for the record, Barak was asked about this recently by the New York Times, and he denied having any underhand relationship. He didn't deny knowing Epstein, but suggested it was all above board.
Mr. Barak, you are mentioned repeatedly in those emails as a close associate of Jeffrey Epstein. Your aide spent a lot of time in Epstein's house. So I just want to ask you very bluntly, did Epstein ever traffic a woman or girl to you or offer one to you?
No, never. I now deeply regret having any association with him, but at the time during my occasional visit to the United States, I was sometimes participating in a breakfast or a lunch or a dinner at his New York townhouse together with respected American public figures. However, not any point in my dealings with him, I did ever witness any improper behavior, and certainly I never participated in anything like that.
Now, what's been remarkable watching this is Nicholas Kristof, who is a columnist for the New York Times, asked this question to Barak recently, and there was no follow-up. There was no question about, hang on, Mr. Barak, there are literally documents that prove that you were assisting and facilitating work for Israeli government and defense contractors around the world, from Mongolia to the Ivory Coast in Africa. These documents have been covered extensively by Dropsite News, a great publication in the US, where I published a podcast series based on my book, The Palestine Laboratory. Now, I encourage people to find these articles and read them and consume them, because what they show in detail is that Epstein really was almost a spokesperson for successive Israeli government ministers and government contractors in an aim to get business, to bring Israeli influence and surveillance companies and defense and arms to nations all around the world.
When you say business, what do you mean by he's introducing business to Israeli prime ministers? And why do you think it was in his best interest to do that? Where did that relationship start?
So a question that's often asked about Epstein is two things, really. One, how did he get so much money? He was a massively wealthy man. It's not entirely clear over the years that he had a normal job, so how did he make all this money? And secondly, how did he find himself in this position? How was he one of the great facilitators and go-to people between himself and countless leaders around the world? And we have lots and lots of documents showing this now, both the documents that were released recently by the Justice Department and the Trump administration, but other leaks that came out last year. It seems pretty clear that someone like Epstein is really at the heart of what this issue is about, namely how the super elite and wealthy work and negotiate with each other. They do not play by the rules. there are no rules when you are Jeffrey Epstein or Bill Clinton or Bill Gates. Now, it strains credibility that people like Bill Gates or Clinton, who deny having any knowledge about anything to do with Epstein's more shameful acts of child rape. Now, I am not in a position to prove that these people knew about those crimes, but certainly to me it strains credibility. They had no idea. And I think in a way Epstein made himself invaluable to so many global leaders, from Saudi Arabia to Mongolia to the Ivory Coast and beyond. I would think because Israeli security and defense interests wanted him to be in that position. He knew all these people over decades. He built these relationships over decades. He often was messaged by powerful people to be asking to be introduced. Person X writes to Jeffrey Epstein, could you arrange a meeting between this person and that person in New York? Can you arrange some kind of facilitation between this company and this country? He became, from my reading of these documents and this story, an absolutely invaluable linchpin of Israeli interests around the world in the last 20, 25 years. And what's remarkable about that is, as this process was happening, certainly after he was charged and found guilty about less than 20 years ago, there was a knowledge in many elite circles of what Epstein was doing with girls, with minors, with children. It was deemed to be either unimportant or irrelevant for the bigger picture of smoothing the path between various global elites. And it wasn't just about Israeli weapons deals and surveillance technology, though it was partly that. It was actually much more than that. He wanted to see himself at the center of global action. He wanted to see himself as someone who many could not live without. So you have all these documents, some leaked in 2025, some coming out more recently, which show him writing to global leaders from Saudi to the UAE and others, and those leaders writing back asking to facilitate meetings with others to arrange business deals. Or, for example, when Prime Minister Modi from India went to Israel and a number of years ago, and there were lots of discussions before that visit about what Modi would be doing in Israel when he went there. It was quite a historic visit, and there are some infamous shots of Modi and Netanyahu wading in the water, almost as best friends. And as I've written elsewhere in the Palestine Laboratory, that relationship between India and Israel was not just about weapons, although it was that too. It was an ideological relationship between the countries, that they both have a ethno-nationalist worldview, they both essentially loathe Muslims, and they are sharing those values on the global stage. India, under Modi, is trying to really, I would argue, either remove or certainly isolate the 200 million Muslims in India, and Israel obviously is running a deeply repressive occupation against principally Muslim Palestinians, although some Christians as well. I think in some ways to understand this story, you need to understand how global elites work. And I'm not part of the global elite, of course, but seeing these documents and other reporting I've done over the years and other people, they're really often based on introductions. Can you introduce me to this person? It's not simply person X emailing a leader of a country for a meeting. It's often facilitated by a middleman. Epstein was known as that middleman. And it seems pretty clear to me that when Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister, who was corresponding with Epstein while he was still in government, talking about business opportunities he could get after he left, and he's made a lot of money in the surveillance and defense sector since, there has been, since Barak left office, unbelievably few international media stories to investigate Barak's role. Why is that? Why are there so few stories, even now, when there are so many examples in the Epstein documents of Ehud Barak, a former prime minister of Israel, who framed himself to some extent on the center left, but actually was a deep believer in endless occupation of Palestinians, as frankly most Israeli leaders are. There's been virtually no reporting on this. And even now, as I said before, when Barak is asked a question by the New York Times about Epstein and dismisses it and says, oh, I'm ashamed of my relationship with him, I should never have met him, there's been no serious stories in much of the global media about the Israeli government and intelligence ties with Epstein or Barak. Why? In fact, what's been happening in the last few weeks is opposite. It is, and this has just struck me as shows that so much of the media is so brain dead on this question. I've seen this covered in Australian press and British press and American press. Now the allegation is that somehow Epstein was working for the Russians. He was a Russian spy. For the record, there is zero evidence so far that is the case. What the documents in fact show is that Epstein was trying to facilitate some kind of meetings between people on behalf of Israel with the Russian Federation and Putin. And yet what we are seeing in much of the Western press is ignoring the hard black and white evidence of clear Israeli intelligence ties between the Israeli state and Epstein, and saying somehow it was Russia, which reminds me of the whole Russiagate nonsense in the last 10 years. For those, I'm sure, who remember this, we've been told since 2015, 2016 that Donald Trump is a Russian asset. He's working on behalf of Putin, and what he's doing in America and the world is on behalf of the Russian Federation. Now, there have been ties between Trump administration people and Putin, and he seems to some extent deferential to Putin in the last decade. That's true. But this idea somehow that Trump has been a Russian spy for years, he's working on behalf of Russia, it's complete fantasy that liberals in America tell themselves of why so many Americans voted for Trump. The argument that still exists in many liberal circles today is that Trump only won the election in 2016 because Putin was putting out ads on Facebook to convince and fool Americans that he was his guy. It's absolute fantasy. Yes, Russia was spending some money on Facebook ads to tell Americans about Trump. That's true, and against Hillary Clinton. But the idea that this was not a legitimate election win, many Americans voted for Trump. I didn't vote for Trump because of Putin or Russia. And in 2024, Trump won the election again because many Americans voted for him. I don't have to like that. That's the reality. So now we have a situation where the Epstein files come out. And I saw some clips in the last few days from British media saying, oh, Epstein was a Russian spy working on behalf of Putin, ignoring the elephant in the room, which is the fact, as I said, that Epstein was clearly working on behalf of, with, and through Israeli intelligence, on behalf of the Israeli government. And it's worth saying on this point that Ghislaine Maxwell, his partner in crime, now serving time in American prison, her father, Robert Maxwell, who was a prominent media mogul who died falling off a boat a number of years ago, was clearly an Israeli spy. There's just no question about that now historically through vast amounts of evidence. Now, does that mean Ghislaine Maxwell was an Israeli spy? I'm not sure, possibly, maybe. But there is a history here. There's a pedigree here. And the fact that much of the media is ignoring that kind of reminds me in some ways of so much of the work that I've done over the years on Israel-Palestine, which is when information is staring us in the face about Israeli actions, much of the media tiptoes around it and prefers to focus on official enemies, Russia, China, Iran, who are malicious governments doing horrible things to their own people. Absolutely. But we have an ally, a supposed ally like Israel, that is doing arguably as many nefarious things within their own borders and beyond. And yet much of the media has a see no evil, hear no evil. And I think it speaks volumes about the racism that exists and the bias and the colonial mindset that is prevalent in much of the Western press. Some of the revelations that came out, this was in fact recently by Dropsite News, not by mainstream media, is in 2006, there was a book that came out called The Israel Lobby by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. It started off as an article, then became a book written by two American academics. Essentially, the book was about how the role of the Israel Lobby is influencing, pressuring in a negative way US foreign policy. Now, you read it now, 20 years on, it's a very sober, pretty undeniable thesis. I have read the book at the time. I've interviewed John Mearsheimer, who's still a prominent academic. And documents have come out that showed that Jeffrey Epstein had worked with Alan Dershowitz, his lawyer at one point, a prominent pro-Israel lawyer, to smear Mearsheimer and Walt, the authors, as vile anti-Semites. And that narrative was very powerful in 2006 and 7, that somehow the only reason you would talk about the Israel Lobby was if you were essentially a Nazi. It's an absurd argument. And Mearsheimer and Walt Not extremists. They're actually pretty conservative guys who are simply saying there's a role of the Israel lobby. Now, it's hard to imagine if that could really fly 20 years on, or at least there is some sane conversation about the malicious role of the pro-Israel lobby. But that was something the documents showed. That now, was Epstein doing that on behalf of Israel as a state? I'm not sure. Was he doing it on behalf of Alan Dershowitz, who was for decades one of the key pro-Israel advocates in America? He was working together, documents show that, just trying to smear these authors.
So do you think that Jeffrey Epstein had a bit of a colonial mindset as well? Did he share colonial values with Israeli government?
It's always hard to speculate about someone's motivation when they're dead, and often when they're alive, they often don't express it. But it's an obvious question, what was Epstein's motivation here? What was his views about Arabs and Palestinians and Muslims and the Middle East conflict? And there's lots of documents now that make it pretty clear that he shared a pretty major colonial mindset. He very much took on the argument of the Israeli right, which has become the Israeli mainstream, which is a belief that Palestinians need to be crushed or isolated or occupied because that's the only way he can maintain a Jewish majority state. There are various conversations he's had with global leaders and others which have been leaked recently, which show very clearly that a belief that there needs to be far more Jews coming to Israel to maintain that Jewish majority. You know, the caveat to that, and I think it's more because he craved the status, was his friendship with Noam Chomsky. And I do want to talk about the relationship. Now, Chomsky is a famed American intellectual, academic. He's still alive in his late 90s. I know Chomsky. I've met him in the last 20 years. He's endorsed a few of my books. I've deeply admired his work over the years. We're not at all best friends, but I've known him for a number of years. And there were some documents that came out a number of years ago about that relationship between Epstein and Chomsky. And this, just for the record, there's no suggestion that Chomsky committed any crimes or went to pedophile islands, nothing like that. Zero. Nothing like that has come out. It's more the relationship with Epstein. Now, having an email correspondence with Jeffrey Epstein's not a crime at all. And there's huge amounts of people in these Epstein files who simply emailed him or got a response. That's not on its own a crime. Of course it's not. But this relationship went far deeper than that. It's pretty clear. And Epstein, I think, in many ways was giving financial advice to Chomsky. Chomsky's wife died a number of years ago and he was having some financial issues with his family, and Epstein was providing financial advice. Again, it's not a crime in that. What's provided some of the controversy is that as before his death in 2019, talking about Epstein, when it was pretty clear by then that the allegations against Epstein were known, the suggestion of raping huge amounts of children and other abuses, it wasn't 100% all confirmed, but it was pretty known. And there's certain details here that are worth reading about Chomsky's response to that. Epstein writes to him at one point and almost asks for his advice how to deal with the firestorm that was developing around him. And Chomsky says, and I'm paraphrasing here, something like, "I've been used to a life of attacks. The best is to ignore it. There's no way to deal with this kind of thing. People are vultures. They just want to feed on you. In other words, they just want to come after you." But one of the things that he talks about, Chomsky, in these emails, which have come out recently, which has caused, including many Chomsky supporters, a great degree of, I guess you could say, upset and concern. And Chomsky is at an age where he's not able to respond anymore because hasn't spoken for a number of years. He lives in Brazil now in the final years of his life with his second wife. And I said he's in his late 90s, that he basically mocks the Me Too movement. And again, it's not a crime to do so. You can still say that, say whatever you want. It's a free country. But he mocks this idea of what he calls hysteria around the Me Too movement a number of years ago and compares what Jeffrey Epstein is going through with that. Now, in hindsight, that reads pretty badly. There's no other way to see that. That, yes, you could argue that everyone is due a trial and they're innocent until proven guilty. Absolutely, I believe that to my core. But by the point when Chomsky wrote those emails to Epstein, the allegations against Epstein weren't simply these hysterical women making false allegations. They hadn't been tried in court, some of them, yes, but they were pretty serious. So it's disappointing to read that. Now, Chomsky may have an explanation for that. He was asked about this a number of years ago, and he said, look, I didn't know about most of these crimes. They came out after his death. My sense is that Epstein saw Chomsky as giving him legitimacy. They would disagree on politics because Chomsky's of the left and Epstein seems to be probably of the right, or certainly on Palestine seems to be deeply colonial and racist. And I think Chomsky saw it as a way to get financial advice, but secondly, to get access to a world, for example, to meet people like Ehud Barak. Now, I don't think Chomsky would have liked Barak, but this idea of getting access to this elite world. Now, again, Chomsky hasn't committed any crimes as far as we're aware whatsoever, and I still deeply admire so much of what Chomsky has done for decades. But it certainly leaves a bit of a sour taste in the mouth, and I hope in some way there's a way to give an explanation for it, although he's no longer going to be able to do that. Maybe his wife will. There is one thing I did want to read, though, that Chomsky wrote to Epstein, and I want to read this email because it's worth reading. And he says, this is an email from June 2015 to Epstein, Chomsky. 40 years ago, Israel was one of the most admired countries in the world. Now it is most disliked. 40 years ago, it was pretty clear, as I wrote at the time, and I was far from alone, that those who call themselves supporters of Israel are in fact supporters of its moral degradation, international isolation, constant conflict, and security problems, and maybe worse. So it has occurred. Israel even now has an official whose task is to deal with international isolation. Israelis like to attribute all this to anti-Semitism, which hasn't changed in the last 40 years, or appeal to the "we have no negotiating partner," which won't wash, namely Palestinians. The problem is not Netanyahu. The policies and problems are much deeper. The crucial question is how long and how far will Israel proceed on the course of self-destruction? Now, you read that today, and there's nothing that he said there which is wrong. The analysis is spot on. He wrote that in 2015. He wrote that to Epstein, and he said that to me and others publicly. So I'm not here to defend the Chomsky relationship with Epstein. It's bad optics at best and is not pretty. And I suppose in some ways that's slightly separate to the question of whether Epstein was an Israeli agent. Chomsky had been an activist critical of Israel for decades. I sense that both of them thought I could get out of something of this relationship. And it seems by the point that a lot of people were certainly aware through reporting of what Epstein was accused of, to maintain a close relationship with Epstein and still seem to be defending him, at least privately, is not a good look.
Do you think you would have been friends with Jeffrey Epstein if he decided to come on this podcast?
You know, one of the things as a journalist is you often correspond with people you don't like. You don't think much of them. They may have committed war crimes. I've spoken to various Israeli officials, for example, who I know have killed Palestinians who have committed war crimes. And I speak to them because I want to get their opinion because I'm interested in their insights. Doesn't mean you endorse what they say by speaking to them or emailing them. The actual act of emailing Jeffrey Epstein is not a crime. Talking to him when he's alive is not a crime. Nor should it be. As a journalist, I would think if I had the chance 10 years ago, 15 years ago, to speak to him, if he was going to give insights into his life, which I suspect he wouldn't have beyond propaganda, yes, there's nothing inherently wrong with having a correspondence with someone. That's what journalists, or at least good ones, often do. You speak to people often you don't like, often you hate, in fact. And it was pretty clear while he was alive that he was a pretty ugly guy for a range of reasons, not least raping children. Now, would I have Jeffrey Epstein on a podcast today, my podcast, if he was alive? I don't know the answer to that. Now, that might be surprising to people. Why would you want to speak to someone like that? I would speak to Netanyahu tomorrow if I had the chance. No question. I would ask him tough questions. I think the role of a good journalist is to often speak to people you fundamentally disagree with. War criminals, ethnic cleansing endorsers, crooks, thugs, pedophiles. Speaking to someone does not mean you endorse them. How you engage with them and speak to them, that is what matters. So if I had the chance to speak to him, if he was alive, I may well take that. But I would give him an incredibly hard time, which frankly, he often didn't speak to lots of media. and I would do my best to at least expose him in some way. And that to me is a healthy thing for an investigative journalist to want to do, not forgetting, and this is the key point, not forgetting through all this, the victims, his many victims, children who were raped and abused, children who are now adults. They need to be the center of one's thoughts and considerations and justice. And I know that the woman that Epstein was married to right at the end of his life was left with a huge amount of money when he died or was killed. And there's still justifiably people who are fighting for some of that money, victims, and they have every right to get that money. So would I speak to him if I could have at the time or now? Yes. Would I feel it was like speaking to a monster? Yes. And both can be true. Thank you so much for watching and listening to the Antony Lowenstein podcast. It's been a really interesting journey since we launched in December 2025. If you like what you're hearing and watching, please support, donate. All information's in the show notes. You can watch on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple. Please send to everyone you can, friends and especially enemies. And more next week. Thank you.